Fire Service Data and Tech Talk. Hey, everybody, it's Eddie Buchanan with the Fire Service Data and Tech Talk on fire engineering and all of the social media outlets. First thing right out of the gate, we're coming up on FDIC. When this thing airs, we're probably right at a little bit over a month away from the big show in Indianapolis. This year, I'm doing a workshop that you want to catch. It's going to be on Monday morning. It is operationalizing data in the fire service. And it's one of those workshops where it's kind of perfect. If you're interested in data, but you're not exactly sure where to start, this is definitely the workshop for you. If you're a 20-year experienced data analyst, probably could take something else. But if you're a fire chief or an officer who's thinking, man, we need to do better with data. What are some tools we could use? How could we implement programs without costing us a bunch of money? This is a good workshop. So it's going to be Monday at 8 o'clock. Try to make that if you can. And otherwise, we'll be there throughout the week. We'll be broadcasting live from FDIC on Thursday. So make sure you catch that. This podcast will be live there. And we'll be hanging around the book booth for the rest of the week. So hope to see you. Hope you've got all your travel arrangements made. It's going to come up really fast. So looking forward to FDIC in April. And this episode, this is really an episode talking about embracing technology. So it's been a theme on the podcast, really, where we look at different things that different fire departments are doing around the country. And there's always an air of kind of a resistance to the culture of embracing technology and using technology to your advantage. And I understand, man, you're probably thinking, like, in the fire department I was in, I had like 10 different things I had to log into, so there's a little bit of some resistance there. But at the same time, it's important that we learn how to run our fire departments like a business, because that's what our elected officials expect and also the communities that we serve. So today I have a couple of great guests that we can kind of kick this around and talk about ways we could do better. I've got Clive and Silas. So you guys, let's go around the horn and introduce yourself. Silas, you go first. Tell us about yourself and where you're from.
Thanks, Chief. I'm Silas Fisher. I'm a fire captain on an engine for the city of Monterey on the central coast of California. I live a couple hours south of that in a little beach town called Cayucas. But I've been with Monterey for about 11 years in the fire service. It was 19 years yesterday, I think. So I got a little time. My main project has been building a paramedic program, putting paramedics on our engine. And that started 9 years ago. We put paramedics on the engine. I was the first one about 5 years ago, and we've been slowly building up. So it's really been, it's a full-time job on top of your full-time job.
Ooh, yeah. I'm gonna have questions about that. That was a big challenge for us in our department too. Still is. And Clive, say hello, man, from the Darth Vader booth you have there.
Yeah, it's my wife's audio booth. I was in the fire service 25 years, most of my career in the San Francisco Bay Area for a big fire department, Contra Costa County, and then I moved on to become a fire chief in 2016 near Sacramento, and ended my career at South Lake Tahoe as the fire chief 2 years ago. I left there to be the CEO of LogRx, a software startup company I've been working at since. And so I just had a long, long career in the fire service, a lot of diverse experience. And I just love the entrepreneurial side. And so I moved on to that aspect.
Welcome. It's great to have you guys both on the show. I think the first question to kick around is, what do we think the greatest liability that fire departments face related to technology and data? Like, where are we? What alligator is closest to eating us when it comes to, everything from the pharmaceuticals we have in storage and on the trucks to the equipment we have and all those types of things? Where do you see our greatest threat? Whoever wants to take the lead on that one.
Clive, I'll let you go because I got to think about it.
Okay. So we always use the analogy with, our company, it tracks narcotics on mobile apps. And so we always use the analogy that, you can use pen and paper to track your narcotics, but it's like driving without a seatbelt. Once something goes wrong, it's too late to put it back on, and whatever the consequences, you're going to have to deal with it. And so to your point and question about data and analytics, which is great that you're covering that at FDIC, fire chiefs, they don't know what they don't know without data. You know, that information is objective. And so it gives you a great basis for when you go to the city manager, city council, and you're trying to get new funding, trying to look for new equipment, ways to protect your staff. If you have data, it really tells you what's been going on in the past and is a great forecaster for what you can face in the future. And so the challenge is by not accepting data and technology is you become stagnant. And you look at any line of duty death report, and there's always items outlined of things that they should have been aware of and things that they probably had warnings about and they ignored. And so if you're just a status quo chief and you don't take advantage of data, then you're negligent in your job, in my mind.
Yeah, I can dovetail into that. I think when it comes to report writing and being able to tell your story. So I had an old retired chief who was always saying, hey, data is how we're going to tell our story. And so if we don't have good data, if the end user, the guy who was on the call, doesn't put in the numbers correctly, then you're not telling your story correctly to your citizens, to the council, and they're not going to give you the money for it. And part of, you know, data is everywhere. It's not just the report writing, but it's how we're tracking things like Clive's program that we use and a lot of other stuff. And so we end up with these gaps. If you're using paper for some things, digital for other things, and the numbers don't match up, you get in some kind of wonky areas. So it's really kind of bridging that hole into a full digital world is what we're kind of aiming for.
Well, you know, like I was the admin chief before I retired, and HR was one of our responsibilities. And one of the things, some of the most delicate situations that either I or my peers in the region had worked with were related to simple tracking of some of the key things that are on a fire apparatus, right? Like, so we ran ALS engines and we had ambulances in the stations as well that were also ours. And that's tricky. Like if we're doing a daily check, let's just say we're checking the drug box and we're gonna go through and make sure all the meds, the drug box is sealed, everything is as it should be. And we make a handwritten record of that. That's only as good as when does that record reach any kind of review, or, you know, where I see the gap or where I have seen the gaps that cause people trouble was the delay in that from the time somebody checked it the day before, they wrote down a note, 24 hours passes. Somebody may or may not notice, you know, that the seal was broken or tampered with on the drug box. Then the next thing we know, we're missing some narcotics, you know, that things are not where they should be. So have you had any experience with that sort of trouble where y'all are from on that, probably the West Coast?
Yeah, I could say as the program manager, and the way I do kind of a true up at the beginning of the end of each month, looking back to when we used any controlled substances, and then kind of looking at all the charts for that stuff. And I check who used it. And then I read the PCR. I kind of look at everything. And so it could be 30 days before I realize there's an issue. And I have had some instances where it's ignorance of the policy on the user's fault, where he just didn't know what he was supposed to do and didn't ask. But trying to track something back 30 days later, and then the guy's on vacation for 2 weeks in Hawaii, I mean, you end up missing out on a pretty big gap with a significant issue. And we're a small enough agency at 6 stations. We're not, you know, I'm not overly challenged on trying to track people down and track down equipment and medication. But it's certainly a bit of a scare, you know, when you find something that doesn't match up and you've got not just your policy, but the county policy, the state policy, and then the DEA, you know, potentially involved. It's not a good thing.
Yeah. And I think from my experience, we had 3 occasions off the top of my memory at Contra Costa County. The first one was many years ago when I was still just a firefighter bottom rank, and one of our outlying, we had 30 stations. One of the outlying stations, the drugs just weren't there. They disappeared. And it was one of those slow stations. We were understaffed, so there was no regular crew there, no regular paramedic. And when they went to check the paper logs, they found that it had only been filled out like 3 times in the last month. And so when they went to do the investigation, it was really extremely difficult. And because of my rank, I never even heard what the outcome was. But we went to a spreadsheet logging system after that. But then that had its faults. My years later, my first day as a battalion chief, my very first shift, one of my aid stations called me and said, hey, we can't find our narcotics. And so I went onto the online spreadsheet and I said, well, you guys have been checking it out for the last week. Where is it? So they searched everywhere, couldn't find it. And it come to find out they had swapped rigs a week prior and just forgot to swap out the narcotics. So they were locked up in a spare fire engine at the shop, you know, 40 miles away, 30 miles away. But because of that, the ability to just pencil whip and say, yeah, they're there, because it was all done on a desktop. So they could just sit in the computer and say, yeah, narcotics are here. And so that human factor and the routine factor, they just checked it off. And it wasn't until somebody actually did their job and checked the narcotics, like, hey, they're not on the engine. And so that's one of the foundations of building the program LogRx, was to find a way to scan it every day so you can't pencil whip it. And then the third occurrence was a malicious incident where someone actually stole all the expiring fentanyl from the EMS division. And that's an easy Google search to see the outcome of that for Contra Costa County.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I was gone for that one.
One everybody heard
for the record, I was gone when that one occurred.
You don't want any part of that one.
No.
Is anybody doing any, I wonder with the technology now, like, you know, on my car keys, I've got a thing that tells me where they are. Have y'all seen anything where they're doing any kind of GPS tracking on these high value assets anymore? Is any fire department doing that?
There's two different methods I've seen. One's the RFID tags, which some will tag it with that, and they don't track it 24/7. It tracks it going in and out of a drug box. There's also a company in the UK that does it for all equipment on an ambulance. So if your monitor leaves the rig, it tracks it. So it tracks when it comes and goes. And then for our program, you scan it with your phone, which then tracks the GPS. So it can track it wherever it's at. And so those are the two I've seen. I'm not sure, Silas, if you've seen others.
No, and talk about a challenge that would be, but no, nothing much. But I mean, Clive's program does a cool thing where it gives you a location when you're scanning things. So there's a little bit of a GPS component, which is kind of a cool feature.
Yeah, that is slick. That would address that you can't really pencil whip it at that point. You got to be standing there looking at the box, and it's going, then the GPS would figure out where you are when you scan the box.
Yeah.
So that's something you could start.
It's funny though. And you know, better than anybody, that if a firefighter is going to figure out, if there's an easier way, that guy is going to figure it out. And they do it all the time. Monthly, I figure out some new thing that they've discovered that they can shorten 30 seconds off their daily work schedule. And it's pretty impressive.
It, you know, even the little stuff, right? Like, so apparatus inventory.
Yeah.
We had a pretty painful experience in our fire department where we had a line of duty death where one of our engines was struck on the interstate during a tropical storm. So it was a bad day all around. But when the engine was pretty well obliterated by that tractor trailer, it killed the lieutenant. Brad Clark was killed that day, and significantly injured two people on the crew. The fourth person, one fourth person, managed to escape any serious injuries, but it really obliterated everything. And it wasn't until after the fact, you know, that we started to appreciate, we had to account for everything that's on that rig from an insurance recovery perspective. So there, you get to, like, they need to know what's in every compartment, what was there, what was the value of it, what was the status of it. Thankfully, we had pretty good records, but I could see, you know, how many fire departments actually have a item by item inventory by compartment that they are confident that is accurate, that they could even begin to recover from such a thing. I mean, you guys had any experience with,
you know, who does do it?
Just general.
The state of California Office of Emergency Services, the green fire engines that most fire stations, fire departments in the state have one that the state kind of puts on loan, right? They require item by item inventory checks. And so that's the only one I could think of. But otherwise, yeah, it's definitely hit or miss.
Yeah, it's kind of department dependent.
Right. And it's such a, you know, it's you don't want to have to learn that lesson the hard way, I guess, but it's important to understand, particularly if we had some fair standardization of the rigs at that point. And we've had long debates about whether apparatus standardization makes sense or not. It depends on where you are, I guess, how diverse your city might be or your locality. But I can see that really being a challenge for fire departments to understand what they had on the rig, what was the value of it. That was something else we learned. We had not maintained necessarily accurate records on valuation of that equipment. It's some of this stuff's expensive. You've got a set of spreaders and cutters in the back of the rig. That's no cheap piece of equipment back there. And what was the value of it? What was, you know, the year, the make, the model, all those things an insurance company would want to know. So, I guess it speaks to the big logistics of running a fire department, you know, the understanding what all the assets are in a fire department.
Yeah, I can say from working in a big department, there was huge value in having the standardization because there are 30 different fire engines. I think we had 8 different trucks. And we were always short staffed because we were under the threat of layoffs and closing stations. And so they just didn't hire for years. So we were like 50, 60 firefighters short for a long time. So you could bounce all around the county. And the station I was at in San Pablo, North Richmond, we could get 2 structure fires a day was not unheard of. And so the second you come on duty, you could get a call for a structure. And I remember for a while we were testing smoothbore nozzles. We were the only engine in the county testing them. And I remember telling the engineer, I said, don't put that on. Or I said, when you go off duty, put back the fog nozzle, because if we get an overtimer, they show up to a fire and all of a sudden they got a smoothbore and they go in, it's going to change everything for them. And so having standardization is huge when you have a big department and just knowing what you have to work with when you get there. So that was really important.
What do you think? There's a great, I don't know, I guess maybe because of the onset of NERIS and some of the more, you know, looking at a new data standard in the fire service and a lot more attention to this topic. What do you think about the culture of the fire service or the culture of firefighters related to data capture and technology itself? What have you seen that works well? What strategies work well to get firefighters to be a little more open to leveraging technology and data?
From the fire chief standpoint, it's something that they're going to not complain about, but tell me it helps their job. And so if it's one more step, one more password for them to remember, they're going to get frustrated. But if it's something simple, like on their phone, something that is easy to get into and it makes their job easier, then it's going to be much more readily adopted. And then obviously I think newer generations, millennial Gen Z, you know, they definitely adopt technology more readily than my generation, Generation X. And so the newer culture is adopted more readily, but you have to make it easy to use. That's critical.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I haven't figured out how to get people to do their reports correctly, or push the narrative that it's important. Everybody wants to go to a fire and that's all they want to do. Even EMS. I mean, I'm the EMS guy. And I have a passion for paramedicine and a passion for having our program in our city. But even getting the buy-in from our non-paramedics to jump in and, you know, be part of the system, they're like, oh man, it's just another nursing home call. It's like, well, you know, people are sick there too. So, you know, that stuff is really challenging. So just getting beyond people to buy into the thing you actually do, the afterthought's even harder. The afterthought being the data input. And I think the one fix is training. It's getting training out, not target solutions based, in-person training where somebody can deliver the message as easily as possible and then demonstrate why it's important on the back end by giving them numbers, you know, quarterly, that's saying, hey, you went on 1,000 calls. You personally went on 1,200 calls this year, or, you know, how many fires or whatever. So, you know, if people can see the outcome of their actions, or, you know, hey, you worked a lot of overtime this year, check out this and look at how many more calls you ran than this guy. You know, that's kind of a little bit of buy-in for that.
You know, I noticed in the workshop I've been doing lately with the data stuff is the topic of law enforcement comes up, and like a comparison of well, they seem to have way more data and way more capability to use it than the fire service does. And so as we break that apart and the reasons why, it starts at recruit school, you know, that they have a significant amount of time dedicated to report writing and capturing data in the field. And the example I always give is park, walk, and talk. That was the law enforcement thing where I live. They still do it. When a police officer marks out at the convenience store to get a soda, he'll mark out that for a PWT, and the dispatcher will timestamp that PWT. And when he gets back in the car after his visit with the convenience store, he clears the PWT call. So that's a community interaction that he just recorded. Although all he did was really go buy a soda, you know, that they were able to capture this many minutes and seconds occurred that this law enforcement officer was interacting with the public. So I compare that to the amount of effort that we make in recruit schools with fire department training. And I don't know, maybe I'm trying to think of the state curriculum in Virginia. I know there's a report writing segment of it. It may be an hour or two that's required. What exposure do they get related to report writing or data capture in out on the, where you guys are on the West Coast?
I can't recall any report writing that goes into recruit school outside of if you're a paramedic. You get a certain level of patient care report documentation standards. We'll spend a couple hours on that, but even then, and then when you do your county, we call it a 10 call, your verification that you meet the county standards, right? You do that, you get all your PCRs reviewed, and then we have a QI person that reads all of our reports. So, you know, there's some ongoing training that's always happening. But outside of that, the big issue we have is new officers training new officers or acting officers, and they just train them the way that they think is best, which sometimes is, oh, you don't have to fill that in. Don't worry about that. One sentence is fine. Why use periods? Who knows what grammar is anyway? You know, it's kind of all the same.
Yeah, and I'd say my experience, same thing. Paramedics were scrutinized because you have to write a report every single call. But if you are not a paramedic, you're an ENT, you didn't write a report until you promoted the engineer and acted up as captain. That would be the first time you actually did a report. And so what we did at Contra Costa County is in 2013, when I took over as training chief, we added part of the probationary requirement of a new captain was they had to take like a business writing class, and they would have to do their final report was a business letter to the fire chief. And the topic was about a line of duty death. And so we re-engaged that so that they had some sort of mentoring aside from like what Silas said, what they think they're supposed to be doing. And I think what, to your point about law enforcement, they get a lot more scrutiny in the reports. So you talk to a paramedic who's had a call go to court, and they have to go give a deposition, and they get torn to pieces because of how bad their grammar is and how their credibility is just ripped apart because of how bad the report writing is. That paramedic is way more efficient after that experience, which I think cops get exposed to on a weekly basis, I imagine.
Yeah, that was my experience. I was writing fire reports as an officer coming up through the ranks, and it wasn't until I went through medic school that I really got any kind of significant report writing training. You know, like you write it like this, you have to include this, it must be complete in this manner. Then they have the QA system going back and checking that on a regular basis, you know, that they bring some accountability to it, which is an important piece. There is something I learned the other day, talking about technology, and we were discussing narcotics and such. Fairfax, we're actually scheduled with them to record, they'll be on a show here probably, I expect, May. They were running artificial intelligence against their protocols versus their reports, their medical, the EMS reports, and the narrative. So they trained this thing to scrub the narrative and the EMS report to ensure that the medications that were given were matching protocol and properly described in the narrative. And it automated it. Wow. They trained it to do that. So that's an example of very high performance. They're always kind of, you know, we tease them a lot. They're kind of like the the top of the pyramid when it comes to leveraging technology and data. But that doesn't mean that any fire department can't or shouldn't be, addressing that or trying to figure out how to do the best you can.
Yeah. One of the other issues we have is that gap from, and you'll both remember this, is handwritten PCRs weren't too long ago. And so we transitioned shortly after I became a medic 12 years ago. It was right in that time frame. And so getting people to realize, hey, you've got more than four lines to write this PCR. Use full sentences, use real words. The acronyms are great and they're still approved in our county scope. But we encourage in our system that people write descriptive reports for, patient care reporting and for fire reporting. And that's a hard habit to break too, is a lot of, fragmented sentences and, just grammar nightmares, hard to understand, things like that.
You're writing a love note to yourself that you may read on the stand one day. So, that's an important piece of that. Man, I was fortunate enough to find myself as a witness in a murder trial once. And the level of detail that you have to sit and recall, that of what you saw, what you did, what all took place. How do you know that that was in fact true? I mean, you couldn't write enough in my view now on a narrative to just capture everything. The carpet was green. I mean, whatever. Every little detail you could think of to help jog your memory downrange, you're going to need it if you have a memory like mine.
Yeah, fortunately, we've been blessed. We have an outside QI person who works in helicopter EMS. And in helicopter EMS, they do very descriptive report writing. And so he's kind of brought that over. And they do it, I think, mostly for billing. And so he's brought that over to us. And we've ended up with some great, very descriptive reports that have circled back around in investigations and things like that. And it's always like, oh, man, thank goodness this is a solid report, not a two-sentencer.
Yeah. We'd always train our captains that your report is your credibility. And so if you have misspelling, bad grammar, or just a lot of omitted information, it's just going to tear you apart when it comes to a deposition.
So if you're a training officer listening to this show, I think my advice would be you might want to beef up your report writing and your recruit school even. I know they probably won't fill out a fire report for, at least all probation probably, but start them young, start them right away to start documenting, maybe writing a report. Ooh, this is a good idea. I wish I'd have thought of this earlier. We should maybe have the recruits writing a report of their daily activities.
Oh yeah.
That they could just come up with a process and you could just have a standard form you could have them complete to document their daily activities. And, what was PT? What did we do? How many reps did we get? What did we, all the little data points that could be possibly captured.
That's a great idea.
And then they're in the swing, right? It's part of the thing. Plus, who knows what you'll learn as the instructor. There may be some leverage there.
And a quick add on to that, it gets a little in the details, but one of the elements that I never realized until we started teaching this class and another instructor brought it to my attention is that when you're writing something that's going to be read by a jury, you want to write it to the seventh grade level. And so, and that may have changed, that was 10 years ago, but there's some online programs where you can feed in, copy and paste your narrative, and they'll tell you what grade level you're writing to. Huh. And so we would train our staff to use that link and say, hey, plug your narrative into here if it's a significant incident. And you want to make sure it's written to like a seventh grade level, because that's what's going to make a jury understand it better.
That's interesting.
A little bit in the weeds,
that's
but
a good point. Yeah.
One of the things
I'm writing a note here.
I know that our recruits and probationary members, they're definitely responsible for email writing. That's our main form of communication. And that's a great place for people to be practicing their report writing skills or just documentation skills in general. We certainly have some members that they lack in their ability to email, appropriately in a semi-formal business manner. It's another one of those things.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. You got your new recruits coming in that are, they, when I got in the fire department, email did not exist yet. Right. So we had to, if I remember, we call them blue missiles. It was actually pretty funny. So if the fire chief wanted to send out a message to the department, they printed it on blue paper. That's why we call it a blue missile. And then the training staff got called from the academy over to the office to pick them up. And we would go hand deliver the blue missiles to every fire station and take all day. Now, it was a nice day to ride around and see the troops and all that. But you spent all day, you know, just to do what would be an email today. So times have changed. But I wonder, is some of the resistance to technology that we perceive and we tend to put that on the generations and the firefighters coming through. But I'm kind of, my hunch is maybe it's not them, because I believe they're probably more tech savvy than the old grays that are sitting around the office that find there's frustration with tech. Maybe it's not them. Maybe it's us, right? Like maybe we don't understand how to leverage technology in the way that they do. Have you seen had any experience with some of the more experienced crowd having challenges with this technology?
Yeah. My experience is that they give up quicker. And so if it doesn't work right out of the gate, they're the one, this doesn't work, and they'll throw it down and complain. And so the newer generations, what's so amazing is that they've been exposed to so much that they know what's good and what's bad when it comes to a program. And so if it works good, they're great. They're readily use it. And so what we found is if you have somebody, and usually when you look at a fire department, you can identify which members, when someone complains, like, okay, that's so-and-so. I knew he was going to probably not be the best. But if you have someone sharp and like, hey, this isn't working and here's why, I shouldn't say sharp. A newer generation is progressive. They probably have really good feedback. And so I think that the benefit isn't just the age factor, but it's the experience. And younger generations have had so much experience with good and bad programs that they're able to quickly identify, oh yeah, this is going to work for us.
That's a good point. And I'll kind of use Clive's program as an example for us. That when I was looking for something to track our narcotics digitally, we were specifically looking for something that was, quote, what do they call it? Firefighter proof. You know, something that they couldn't mess up, or that was going to be obvious how to do it. And I looked at several programs and kind of happened into LogRx through an email that went to one of my chiefs from one of Clive's coworkers, Sky, and said, hey, I'm working on this thing. And he passed it to me and I did a sample, and it was totally firefighter proof. It was kind of just what we were looking for. And we got good buy-in because of that, because it was simple. My training program on it takes about 25 or 30 minutes to run them through a quick PowerPoint that shows all the possibilities of things you would need to do for it. And then that's it. And then they get to practice. So, you know, pretty simple program.
I've noticed that, and it's just my impression, what I think I see is one of the differences we see with folks that are more accustomed to technology versus someone who may not be, is the ability to solve problems, right? Like, so I know some folks, if they get a new piece of technology, if they have not been shown how to operate it or had get an error in any way, it doesn't go the way they thought it would. They, like you said, they just kind of put it down. Like, well, this doesn't work. So they just, that's the end of that. They'll never touch it again. But those that are more experienced with technology can operate more intuitively through the interface, right? Like, so they're not scared to push a button and see what happens. You know, you just bang around in it until you figure it out. That's kind of how I tend to operate. I'm not sure what to do, but let's see what that button does, you know, and then just keep pushing buttons until you figure something out. And you learn that way, right? Just trial and error. I guess as long as the application, whatever it might be, is built to not implode when somebody's just poking around on it like that. That seems to be a difference I've noticed with kind of two schools of thought. Maybe, I don't know that it's generational. It might just be there are some that are not scared to push the button and see what happens, and some that need step-by-step directions to navigate, I think. I don't know, but that's just my experience. What do you guys think?
When something isn't flawless, that's when we have issues with our older generation of officers. For example, we went to a digital tablet on-scene documentation for medical calls. Another real hard push, and we're still not all the way there. But if the tablet freezes or glitches for any reason, that's when we have real issues. And I get an email or a phone call that says this thing doesn't work, and you know, it's something simple, it needed to be updated, or it just had a bad day. And those are definitely hard ones. Is if something doesn't work perfectly, there's not a lot of willingness to try again.
Yeah, and I think the troubleshooting factor is huge. And I'll use myself as an example of not adopting technology when I was when they introduced the digital pressure gauges on fire engines. So I was trained on the old Ford C8000 fire engines where it's 100% mechanical. And then all of a sudden, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, but probably in the early 2000s, NFPA started requiring that or guide that a standard to require all new engines to have the digital where you get out of the engine, you push preset and it goes to the set pressure. And there was times when all of a sudden it go to idle. I couldn't figure out why. And it's like, well, the pump was cavitating or something weird. And so it just put it idle. Whereas on the old C8000s, I could troubleshoot that. I could probably do it today if you put me in front of one of those old engines. And so I used to get extremely frustrated and think, why are they doing these digital pressure sets? I just want to have a pump panel with analog gauges and I'll figure it out. And so I think I could, if you look at my brain, I could troubleshoot that. The technology for a new digital one, I would lock up because of that handicap in my brain that was just being emotional of, no, I don't want this. I want my old fire engine back. I don't want to take the time to troubleshoot this when I could do it manually. And so I think that factor for some of us that might be older generations.
I lived through that one, man. We actually had some guests on the show a couple months ago. They were talking about that. I think it's the name of the SAM is the name of the pump system where it's digital and it's automated. So there's no levers, right? It's even beyond the digital gauges. It's like the levers are gone. So it's basically you're using a tablet to open and close discharges and all that intake and all that stuff. And my initial impression was like, I don't know, man, you know, I still climb under the truck with a mallet and try to fix it. You know, that's kind of, so I was really skeptical, but they made a good point. They used the analogy of an airplane, you know, because we were in fact middle of the country someplace when this conversation was happening. And they said, how did you get here? I said, I flew. They said, when did you notice the most turbulence in the flight? I said, takeoff and landing, obviously. When were the humans involved in the flight of that aircraft? Takeoff and landing. I was like, well, yeah. And he goes, so you'll ride on an airplane that's flying on a computer program, basically autopilot. Don't you think we could squirt some water here with a little technology? And I'm like, yeah, you got a point. You know, I mean, it's as long as there's redundancy and the ability to troubleshoot it in some way, if I have a problem, then yeah, why wouldn't I do that? Right. So, and what was interesting in that discussion was they were leveraging that technology to improve or redistribute staffing, I guess is maybe redistributing of the staffing on scene. So a good example would be if I have a pump operator that can operate a tablet, he's operating the fire attack and all that's going on. Water supply is good. He can, is it possible for him from a mental bandwidth to take another tablet and set it next to it and operate the other engine? Could he theoretically operate two engines at once? Because you don't have to actually go over there and pull levers or reach, you know, check the heat on the keystone or anything, you know, all the manual stuff we used to do. And they can build automation into the process. So, and, you know, there's almost a mental argument in my own head about I have apprehensions because I'm an old guy. And then I also am a little bit of a tech nerd, so I can appreciate how that might influence fire department operations, you know? And the initial gut reaction to everybody I've talked to about it has been, the same one I had. So it's interesting trying to get firefighters and fire officers to, I think instead of just pushing back on technology, we should be asking questions about it. Can I use this tech, whatever it might be, to improve firefighting operations. Like, I've been on a big drone kick lately. I think every command buggy ought to have a drone flying at the top.
Drones are cool.
The thermal imager. Yeah. So because a thermal imaging, you know, using a thermal imager on side A, B, and C of a structure is one thing. Looking at it from the roof is a completely another, that's a whole another a view of what's going on inside the building. So I take that aerial view over the, over a ground view every day, all day, because it's so telling.
Yeah.
I mean, you learn so much very quickly, and it's not that expensive. So, I think is our challenge, is to get firefighters and officers to, rather than just stiff arm the technology, and, you know, at least wrestle with it and see, you know, is it, does it provide any valuable, any tactical value on a fire ground or in the office, depending on what, you know, some of this stuff is business related, running a fire department like a business, but we're kind of leaning towards operational right here at this moment. But
I think one great example of embracing technology is as simple as using Google Maps. Our engines are equipped with an engine iPhone. We have an engine iPad also. And when I started, it was not normal to use one of those devices. They wanted you to open up the map book and confirm your route of travel to the incident. You know, whatever neighborhood, hey, it's going to be the fourth house, but you have no picture of what the house looks like. You know, you got nothing. But now I can quickly put in the address and I could say, oh, this is going to be a three-story Victorian. This is, you know, way different than a single, you know, 600 square foot little dwelling. So it's going to change my thought process en route to the call, whether I'm first or third in. And so that's one of the big things, is we've gone away from this giant map book. And now we do use a map because it's got all of our hydrants on it. But even that is technology-based now. We're trialing out some new apps that show all of our hydrant data. So, you know, we're quickly transitioning away from anything paper and laminated. But that's across the board. Everybody's using Google Maps, and I think it's great.
The street view is handy, man. They would wake me up at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning for a structure fire being dispatched. And I wasn't necessarily going to respond. You know, the battalion chief's got it. But I would pull the street view on that address and see what they were working with. You know, is this a you know, 1800 square foot rancher, or is this a 5,000 square foot mansion? You know, it's that may change my status of going back to sleep.
Yeah.
or rolling out, you know, getting on the move. So yeah, street view is, and then now, like, we just had a episode recently with Frisco, Texas, where they have a system that is unlike anything I've ever seen. They call it Safer. You ought to check that out. It was, it's pretty amazing. They just on a tablet can see just any and everything, even live feed cameras. Wow. So that's a very powerful system. Let's switch over to the business side of the house a little bit. I've noticed one thing interesting since I retired, and I work for a technology company that we deal with a lot of big fire departments, and you can kind of see trends a little easier from the seat I'm in now, right? Like, I'll see the joke I'll make sometime is, well, they NACO or ICMA must have just had a class, because you see this push across the fire service where all of a sudden this theme comes out. I'm like, all right, somebody must have wrote an article or something. So, but I think that's important to understand that, you know, your city managers and your mayors and elected officials, they go to conferences too. Right. And they're hearing about the latest, greatest in data informed or, you know, data driven type of municipal governments. So they're bringing that back to their fire chiefs. And it's challenging to be able to articulate growth, trends in response. We just got back from the CPSC Excellence Conference. I think you guys had a booth there. I saw down the hallway. I'm pretty sure I saw it. That, you know, there's a strong push to get fire departments to operate more like a business. And what are you guys seeing as far as trends, technology, the ability to articulate growth or needs, logistics needs, anything? You know, we've talked about narcotics. We've talked about equipment, forecasting budget needs in a way that affects the planning process in local government. What are you seeing on the West Coast? It's kind of cool, y'all. But I'm East Coast, y'all the West Coast. We can kind of have like a Bruno Brennan Unplugged kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that on the West Coast, I'm not sure how it's back there, but funding measures and just how fire, especially fire districts, you know, with fire departments and fire districts. Fire districts in California are funded through property tax, and that's been declining the allocation, or I shouldn't say it's declining. It's not keeping up with the costs of running a fire department. And so on the West Coast, there's been a much bigger push to do more with less. And when you can't do that, can you share efficiencies with your neighbors? And so I think that there's been a really big push for consolidations, annexations, and then JPAs combining efforts. And so realizing you can't do it on your own. When I went to South Lake Tahoe as a fire chief, they didn't have an automatic aid agreement with their neighbors. And there's only three firehouses. Like, how can we even manage a single house fire? And so immediately rebuilt those. In fact, in my job interview, I told them, don't hire me if you don't want to have automatic aid with your neighbors, because that's going to be my first thing. And so I think that aspect of improving efficiencies through collaboration has been a huge factor on the West Coast.
Yeah, I know that one of our struggles internally, and I think it's big with a lot of departments, is their prevention bureau. It's maintaining a prevention staff, and then how you can efficiently handle all of your inspections. On the West Coast, not only are they doing commercial occupancy inspections, but we have to do our entire jurisdiction. We have to do for a wildland inspection for wildland threat. And so we physically have to drive around and look at every structure and look around it and see what's going on. And so, but being able to utilize for the prevention bureau to be efficient in their process so they can get more done. Our fire chief really puts a lot of concern into, is prevention doing enough? Because ultimately that's one of our main goals, is let's prevent the fire before it can even happen.
Community risk reduction. I mean, that's really what we're, I feel like we're still trying to articulate exactly what that is, but we're working really hard as a fire service to be able to articulate it. And the value of it, I think also that's an important piece. I think you're right. The consolidation, I guess, the ability to work together. Boundary drops is the term we use with the company I work for. Is it a boundary drop or not? Right. Like there's mutual aid, then there's auto aid, then there's this erase the boundaries and the units go where they have to go within that region. To me, that seems like the way to, I can see where fire chiefs can think of these things as silos. And if you had a full boundary drop, you know, that could be hard to maintain autonomy, I guess, and king of the hill kind of thing from a, just call it what it is, you know, the maintaining the power of that organization. But at the same time, when things go bad, when the economy tanks, or we get into something like a COVID, where, you know, the analytics company that I work for, we did a lot of simulations of reduction of service, which is, you know, like the slang term is browning out companies, right? Like, so we're going to brown out this engine, brown out that station, whatever. And how many hours a day and which ones and what sequence. And those are painful scenarios to run because, you know, you're reducing service to a community. But the problem is if you haven't done, if you're not running your fire department like a business beforehand, you're kind of at a disadvantage because you won't have the information and the data you need to be able to fight to maintain service. You know, that's not something you're going to get. We used to tell people all the time, if you don't have a line of duty death, you know, procedure and policies and teams and all the things in place, if you think you're going to do that when one occurs, you're going to be, you know, it's going to be painful. You're not, you can't, you'll fail. I mean, you can't do something that complex that fast. You've got to have that stuff in place ahead of time to do it with any grace. And the same goes here with running your fire department like a business, I think. So, you know, it's, we've just starting to see a couple of analyses that have been, you know, they've been a couple of requests to look at which station again should be, how do we reduce service and what areas and when. Just starting to get those requests again, which makes me a little nauseated, you know, when that stuff starts to come. So I was in Canada. I went up there years ago teaching a class, and they were, I asked at the beginning of that class, I would always ask, what challenges are the Chiefs? What are y'all facing? What's the big challenge these days? And the whole room erupted with amalgamation. And I was like, what do you get a shot for that or what? I don't know what that is. I never heard of that. And turns out they explained it as that's when the local government or the governments force merge fire departments. Huh. So they just, you don't get a say in it. They just tell you, hey, on this day, these three fire departments are now one fire department. Y'all figure it out. And they were apparently having a lot of that. But, and that, you know, that's in Canada. That's what they were doing back then. I don't know if they're still doing it now or not, but I took that back to the States to go, you know, it's not something they always do, but it could happen. Failure to run your fire department with sound business practices and sound data. If you don't do that, it's like the old, we used to tell company officers back in the day, you know, and still to this day, it matters. If you don't fix the problem in your firehouse, then somebody's going to come fix it for you eventually. And they're not going to fix it with the same values and opinions that you have. They're going to fix it with what they want to do. So the best thing you could do as a lieutenant is square that away in your quarters and take care of it before somebody does it for you.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes at the fire department level. If you don't run your business and you know, cooperate with your partners, you might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, something's going to happen and somebody's going to come fix it for you. Soapbox. So sorry.
No, that was in my expectations as a fire chief. I said, you come to me anytime you want with a problem, but if you don't come with the valid solution, I'm going to come up with a solution that you may or may not like, but you can't complain. So come to me with a solution if you also have a problem. But to your point about the brownouts and coverage and efficiencies, going back to running your fire department like a business, something that we fail in a lot is marketing. And so we market ourselves to our customers, which is the public, to emphasize the value we bring to them. Just like if you had a product you're trying to sell, you want to tell them how it's going to solve whatever pain point they've got. And if that pain point is becoming obsolete, like how often do you see actually house fires compared to what we used to have? So you try to offer other services, fire prevention to help reduce their homeowners insurance or whatever it is. You need to run your fire department like a business to always be relevant so that when they do come to brown out a station, you have an argument or you have data to say, here's why you should keep it open. And so that's another big area of running your fire department like a business.
Our smart clients that do have the data and they do have the ability to run these scenarios could fend that off because they would show what the response would be under those conditions. This would be the extension in response times, so how much more time we're talking here. And they could even take that further to show who that extended response time is going to happen to. So we could weave in the socioeconomic data to get those layers in there so that we could see that, you know, we already have an underserved segment of the community. And now you want us to extend the response times in there? You know, maybe you want to go look someplace else. And they often would. That was always, particularly when you can isolate it to an elected official, you know, like, you know, zoom in on their election district. Now you're playing hardball, you know? So it's that's an important piece of that. So if you're not, like I said, if you're not heads up and running your fire department with that kind of business intelligence, you're certainly asked, may not get you today, but it's going to come get you sooner or later.
Yeah, that political aspect is huge too, because back in, I think it's 2012, when I was tasked with finding six firehouses to close because we were just so short on funds following the crash. And so I determined the six stations, took it to the assistant chief and the fire chief. They basically said, those are our highest paying cities. And so we were going to brown out the stations where the city was paying far more than their share. And they were keeping open the busy firehouses in the very low socioeconomic areas because that's where the fires were at. And so it's not just the data, but then you also take in the political factor, which is a whole another nightmare.
You know, one of the small things, I'm all about product branding. So it's, what's our brand? And one of the small examples I have is when we created our paramedic program, I wanted to make sure that we had a paramedic patch that went on all the paramedic sleeves in their uniform shirt. And it's all about selling our product. You know, hey, we are now paramedics and most people don't know what it is, but we're a big tourist community. And of course, a lot of firefighters are on vacation in our town. And so for them to see, oh, hey, they've got paramedic on the side of their engine, they've got paramedic on their sleeve. I didn't see that last year or whatever. You know, it's one small thing. So branding what we're doing and using social media for that, sharing with the community. Our nonprofit for our union side does a huge amount of community events, and it's been great. And we share all that on social media, and people see our logos and they love that. And then the city, same thing, is putting out what our fire department's doing with press releases. You know, it's all part of the business aspect. It's, hey, here's what you're paying for this service. Here's what this service has been doing for you.
Yeah, you want everybody in the community to know a firefighter.
Yeah.
Personalize that thing.
Yeah.
You know, so when there's a vote or a consideration that's going to, you know, be harmful, they go, well, that's happening, not happening in the fire department. That's happened to Bobby down at the firehouse, I know. You know, that's a much more powerful thing.
And social media makes it free. And so if you're trying to market your agency, you're trying to personalize it, everyone has social media nowadays. And so that's free. Just assign someone in your department for that shift to be the social media person. Have a good policy so they know what to post and what not to post. But that's a great way to just really get out and be a good positive influence on your community.
Yep. Run it like a business.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts? We're about getting close to the hour. We'll get ready to wrap things up. Any Clive, any last things you want to hit us with?
Just say thank you for having us. It's been fun. And just the piece of advice I give for running it like a business is, if you're stagnant, you're failing, just always push to improve. Do something to improve your service to the customer. Keep the firefighters happy, but always strive to improve.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I can agree. Being on the floor still on the engine, it takes everybody from the least senior firefighter up to the senior captain and battalion chiefs, that when you see something that can be improved and you know of a way to improve it, that you bring it forward and we improve it together. And a lot of that has to do with embracing technology and, you know, hydraulic extrication tools and narcotics tracking digitally and all those great things. So it's a process for sure.
It's certainly going to be a fun time to be in the fire service, right? The next 5 or 10 years will be unlike anything we've seen historically to date.
I think. Yeah.
Should be a lot of fun. Well, thanks for being on the show, guys. Folks, that's a wrap for the Fire Service Data and Tech Talk this month. Again, this is airing in March, so you know what next month is. We'll be at FDIC starting on April 15th through the 20th in Indianapolis. So be sure to come out and see us at the show there. And the Fire Service Data Tech Talk, you can find that on fireengineering.com. You can find it on all their social media outlets. And you can also find us on Twitter, the handle is Data Tech Talk on Twitter, and also Eddie Buchanan on LinkedIn. So thanks again for listening this month, and we'll see you at FDIC next month. Take care.
Fire Service Data and Tech Talk.